Now, let's be clear. A ceasefire could have come about months ago if Hamas had been willing to release hostages. Months ago. Instead, Hamas continues to stand in the way of peace, to throw up roadblocks, cower in tunnels beneath Gaza cities and behind under civilian infrastructure and hide among the civilian population.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield today. The U.N. Security Council passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the unconditional release of all hostages. The U.S. cleared the way for the approval by abstaining from the vote after vetoing previous ceasefire resolutions. In response, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled a trip to Washington by a delegation that had planned to discuss a possible Israeli offensive in Gaza. We're going to talk about all this now with Matt Duss from the Center for International Policy. He's also a former foreign policy advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks, Marisa.
So tell us what's in this resolution that passed today and how different was it from the previous versions that the U.S. vetoed?
Well, I think, you know, the main elements in today's resolution are that it calls for an immediate ceasefire. And previous resolutions that the U.S. had been willing to support, it had blocked resolutions with this language in the past and preferred to say to call for a ceasefire when one was practical or achievable. So I do think that that is important. It calls for an immediate ceasefire to last till the end of the month of Ramadan, which is about two more weeks. It also calls for all parties to, of course, observe international law and international humanitarian law, and calls for the immediate release of hostages.
So the U.S. decided not to block this resolution, but they didn't vote for it either. And this comes out, obviously, after vetoing multiple calls for ceasefire over the last 5 months. Why do you think the U.S. abstained this time? What's changed?
Well, I think they've been under, you know, obviously considerable pressure, both in the U.N., internationally and domestically. I think we have to take that into account. We've seen, you know, increasing pressure from the president's own party, most notably the Michigan primary a few weeks, where over 100,000 Democrats voted for the uncommitted, you know, as a way of registering their protest against Biden's Gaza policy so far. So all of this has been adding up. And I do think there's also a great deal of anger, let's say, from the Biden administration toward the Israeli government right now, particularly toward Netanyahu, who has continually rejected and just, you know, behaved in a way that it doesn't really appreciate the enormous amount of support that the United States has been giving to Israel, both in terms of military aid, political support, and diplomatic support at the UN. They're currently in this, you know, in a public argument now about whether Israel, the Israeli military, will move into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which the Biden administration is now saying explicitly should not happen. Because it would clearly lead to an even greater humanitarian catastrophe than already exists. Netanyahu, for his part, seems very happy to use, you know, this fight with the United States for his own domestic political purposes, because that is always Netanyahu's number one concern, is his own political prospects.
Right. And he faces an ousting potentially when this war ends. I mean,
that's right.
Before we get back to the U.S. politics, though, I'm curious, you know, Gaza's health ministry says 32,000 Palestinians have been killed in the region since Israel began responding to the October 7th Hamas attacks. And while this resolution deplores acts and violence against civilians, does it carry any weight? Like, will it have any practical implications?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, it is not a magic wand that will force a ceasefire, but it does add to, you know, pressure on all the parties, including Israel, to reach that ceasefire. It's not just Hamas that has been rejecting ceasefires. Netanyahu has also been rejecting certain ceasefire deals. This has been a weeks-long process with senior U.S. officials like the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, and CIA head Bill Burns traveling to the region, trying to help negotiate a release of hostages and Palestinian prisoners held by Israel to achieve this ceasefire, which would be temporary. But I think all the parties, you know, the United States certainly hopes will turn into a more permanent ceasefire. But so the answer to your question is no, this does not ensure a ceasefire. But again, it does kind of add to the pressure,
right,
in expressing the, you know, the very strong, if not overwhelming, international consensus that this war needs to come to an end.
Right. I mean, and you mentioned Netanyahu, his politics, he canceled this delegation visit to D.C. to discuss the invasion of Rafah, which the U.S. opposes. I mean, do you worry that this resolution and the sort of schism between the U.S. makes that incursion to Rafah more likely?
I don't. I think Netanyahu, in some ways, again, he enjoys or he's able to use this argument for his own purposes. If they decide not to go into Rafah, I mean, it's clear that he is kind of preparing the ground for arguing that, well, we weren't able to fully succeed in our goals in Gaza because the United States wouldn't let me. But the fact of the matter is, we've already seen that this war has not really achieved a lot of its goals. It has weakened Hamas, certainly. It has not eradicated Hamas. It will not eradicate Hamas. So I think everyone, particularly Netanyahu here, is trying to prepare the ground for their own political arguments in the future.
Yeah. I mean, we saw Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest ranking Jewish official in the U.S., give a pretty scathing speech recently where he called for Israelis to oust Netanyahu. I mean, what does that tell you about just like where we're at with this alliance right now with, you know, one of our strongest allies?
Yeah, I think Senator Schumer's speech was remarkable for a number of reasons. One is some of the things he was saying, you know, particularly his you know, the comments he made about using U.S. leverage and pressure on Israel if Israel did not do certain things or stop doing certain things. You know, this kind of talk about conditioning aid, even though I think he has avoided use of that term, in my view, that is clearly what we were talking about. This kind of talk was taboo on Capitol Hill just a few years ago. And now not only is it very much part of the conversation, it's part of the conversation by one of the most conservative pro-Israel Democrats in the Senate. So I think that's just one of the reasons why this was very significant.
Well, I mean, he is clearly not the only top U.S. official, though, who's a strong ally. I mean, we've seen Biden really go to bat for Israel.
Yes.
And the U.S. has given the country more aid than any other nation since its founding. Currently, right. It stands around $4 billion a year. I mean, do you think that this conversation around conditioning aid is actually going to sort of move forward? I think we've heard calls from the left, but it's pretty striking to see U.S. top officials question this military offensive that our dollars are paying for and that our
That's
weapons
right.
are being used in.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, part of what's significant about Schumer's speech is that Congress is kind of always the last one to get the memo on these things. I think this shift in opinion, and particularly in the Democratic Party, has been ongoing for a long time. We've seen it in the polls. We've seen it in members of Congress who have been elected to Congress, you know, new, strong progressives who are taking a much more consistent approach on issues of human rights, and that includes Palestinian rights. They refuse to make a special exception in the case of Palestinians, as I think a lot of others do. But I think we're seeing the shift in the party. We've been seeing this for a long time for a lot of reasons. But I think Schumer's speech is just the latest indicator of that. But as you said, President Biden takes a much more conservative, I would say, kind of old school view here. But even he is having to respond. And I think we can say safely that Joe Biden will be the last president from the Democratic Party to take this view, precisely because the party has changed so remarkably.
Yeah. All right. Less than a minute left. I just want to ask, like, what is next? We still have millions of civilians in Gaza who are at risk. More than 100 Israeli hostages still thought to be in Hamas hands. What are you watching for in the coming days?
I'm hoping that we actually do get that agreement that they've been trying to negotiate in Doha and elsewhere, a ceasefire for at least a few weeks, a release of hostages, a release of prisoners, and then create an opportunity to get desperately needed aid to the people in Gaza who are facing starvation at an enormous scale, as every international human rights NGO has been warning now for weeks. And at the same time, hopefully, using that moment to negotiate a much more longer term ceasefire to continue getting that aid into Gaza.
All right, we'll leave it there. Matt Duss is an executive vice president at the Center for International Policy and served as a foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, our legal eagle Jessica Levinson tells us what's at stake in the abortion pill case before the high court. And what does a new AI tool for music mean for the industry? We dig in next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brand. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a case that could significantly limit the use of the abortion drug mifepristone, which is used in more than half of all abortions in the U.S. It's the biggest case dealing with reproductive rights since the 2022 Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, and how the justices rule could have even bigger implications for the entire pharmaceutical industry and the power of federal regulatory agencies. Joining me now is Press Play's legal eagle Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School. Hey, Jessica.
Hi.
All right, back to talk about another SCOTUS case. Tell us first, who brought this case to the Supreme Court?
Some conservative doctors and some conservative medical groups who I think realized that this was their time to challenge what the FDA did in loosening its restrictions on mifepristone, not just approving mifepristone in 2000, but loosening those restrictions in 2016 and 2021, because after, as you said, after the Dobbs decision, which of course erased protection for reproductive choice from the Constitution, this has become a much, much bigger avenue, path for women to obtain abortions. And therefore, it was within the crossfire, meaning to take abortion pills as opposed to having a surgical procedure.
So the group originally argued that the FDA should never have approved mifepristone for abortion, but I understand they've since changed their argument. I mean, what's the legal kind of case based on?
So it's not so much a change, I think, as a peel back. So the original case said that mifepristone should never have been approved at all in 2000, that the FDA rushed through the process, that they ignored facts and science, that mifepristone actually isn't safe. Of course, we have almost a quarter century of evidence to indicate that it's quite safe, even safer than Tylenol. And they also argued, well, if the original approval was okay, certainly the loosening of restrictions in 2016 and 2021, that is not permissible. And so legally speaking, it's interesting because this case has everything to do with abortion, but then on the other hand, nothing to do with abortion because, as you said, it's also about the power of executive agencies. So one of the three legal issues before the court is, did the FDA act in a manner that's, quote, arbitrary and capricious when it loosened those restrictions on the use of mifepristone? And the reason that that standard is arbitrary and capricious is because built in is the understanding that we have to give deference to executive agencies and the experts that work there. And we can't allow judges to just stand in the shoes of members of these agencies and say that their decisions are improper without that level of deference.
So I'm not a lawyer, Jessica, but we've been following a lot of these cases. And I'm curious, like, are they actually, like you mentioned how safe and effective this drug has been, how many years we have showing that. So are they, the anti-abortion doctors, are they actually arguing that their patients were hurt by FDA approval of this drug? Like, don't you have to show some harm usually in order to have standing in a lawsuit?
Such a good question. And so, and again, I would kind of focus all of us on not just the approval, as you mentioned, but also, and I keep saying the loosening of restrictions. So what do we mean by that? Essentially, the loosening of restrictions means now you can prescribe mifepristone up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. Now it's not just doctors, but it's also physician's assistants and pharmacists who can prescribe mifepristone. And really key to the practical and legal implications of this case, now you can get mifepristone via a telehealth appointment and dispensed through the mail, which obviously makes a huge difference to women in states where abortion is severely restricted. But you asked me about standing. I mean, this to me is the biggest legal hurdle that I think we'll hear about tomorrow morning a lot when the case is argued before the court, which is these doctors are saying, I might at some point have to provide care to a woman who was prescribed mifepristone by somebody else, then had a rare side effect, and then comes to me for assistance.
Huh. Okay. That feels, I don't know, far field, but we'll see what they say. How has the government, FDA, responded to this challenge? It seems like, as you alluded to, presenting this type of challenge to their authority is unprecedented and could undermine their authority and process for all drugs.
Well, that's essentially what they're arguing here, which is not just that they didn't rush the process, not just that their decision wasn't arbitrary and capricious, not just that, in fact, mifepristone is much more highly regulated than, to the extent there are similarly situated drugs, than similarly situated drugs. And so the truth is mifepristone has been under more restrictions than other drugs that are less safe, for instance, like Viagra or Tylenol, which you can get over the counter. But what the FDA also is trying to point out, and I think we'll hear about this tomorrow, is the idea of the slippery slope, right? Do we now want one group with dubious standing to be able to go to a judge and say, everything the FDA did a quarter of a century ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, they were wrong. And now, so you judges stand in the shoes of that executive agency and turn over that restriction and validate it. Because that would mean it's not just mifepristone, right? It's every other drug that has been approved by the FDA that is potentially within the crossfire. Now, of course, the truth is that there aren't a lot of doctors who are standing in line to challenge cholesterol medication and blood pressure medication because, again, this case has nothing to do with abortion and everything to do with abortion.
I mean, does that mean that this court, which, you know, it bears repeating, did overturn Roe v. Wade, could sort of look at that standing question and kind of punt this case and say, you know what, we're not going to touch this. It's too messy.
Well, I mean, and that would be, I think, nice for them because in part what they said in the Dobbs decision, which again was the decision overturning Roe v. Wade, is, well, now we're out of the business of talking about abortion. Let's leave this to the states. Of course, they're not nearly out of the business of talking about abortion. And so one way for them to avoid, as you're kind of alluding to, the big merits question, but also to keep their standing doctrine intact, is to say the people who brought this case, they're not injured enough. So it was these doctors with, in my view, very speculative injuries, and also medical associations, which the trial court judge said could continue in this case because they were basically standing in the shoes of women who the trial court judge said were too traumatized to bring the case themselves. So I think we're going to hear a lot about standing when the court hears these arguments tomorrow. And that is, again, something your views on the standing doctrine should have nothing to do with your views on abortion. And so it'll be really interesting to see how the justices tackle that.
Yeah. All right. Just a few minutes left with you. I want to shift gears to talk about two big legal developments on this Monday for former President Donald Trump. The former president was thrown a lifeline in a civil fraud trial that was brought by the state of New York. We talked last week how he had appealed this $454 million bond. He's being ordered to pay just $175 million of it while the appeal is pending. What does that mean?
It means he doesn't have to pay quite as much, but for now, right? So if his appeal is not successful, and or if it's not successful on his quest to get the amount of monetary damages reduced, then he will eventually have to pay that amount of money. But this means that the kind of nuclear options that we've talked about before, you know, will they seize his property, which properties, all of that is put off until later when the Court of Appeals decides whether or not, again, the amount of damages was appropriate and whether or not the ruling at all was appropriate. So it could just postpone the inevitable.
All right. Finally, before I let you go, there's this other case, a criminal trial regarding hush money payments he made to the adult film actress Stormy Daniels, actually set to go to trial on April 15th in New York. What do you think we'll see?
I think we will see that trial go on April 15th. Of course, the former president was in court this morning asking that that case either be dismissed or postponed even further because there were some documents that the Trump team and the prosecution didn't get from federal investigators. The judge this morning, very skeptical of the Trump team's arguments, saying essentially you created this delay and now you're complaining about the delay. So this is a complicated case. I know we'll get into it another time, but I expect that it will begin in mid-April.
All right. That is Jessica Levinson, Press Play's legal eagle and professor at Loyola Law School. Tomorrow on Press Play, you may not know Judy Baca's name, but you have seen her murals around L.A. She is finally getting mainstream attention and is the subject of a new L.A. Times short documentary. And coming up, Alinda Segarra of Hooray for the Riff Raff is making music that reflects real life, including the fentanyl crisis.
And I think that's like the beauty of song is you can spread information, you can make people feel not alone, and you can also create a time capsule for people in the future to know what we were dealing with now.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play from 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, filling in for Madeline Brandt.
In this long, a bold, empty bleak, I'm just a soul trapped in this circuitry.
The classic sound of Mississippi blues. But that soulful wailing isn't a contemporary Son House or Robert Johnson, because that entire song, vocals, lyrics, melody, guitar, was generated by artificial intelligence. The music was made by an algorithm from a new AI company called Suno, with lyrics from ChatGPT. And Brian Hyatt wrote about the company and AI's implications for music for Rolling Stone. He is host of the Rolling Stone Music Now podcast and joins me. Welcome to Press Play, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really happy to have you. Fascinating story here. That piece of music we heard came from a prompt you put into Suno. You said, solo acoustic Mississippi Delta blues about a sad AI. What was your reaction when you first heard it?
So, you know, I actually did it in the Suno offices. I was up there and they were showing me their new version, which is called V3. And that actually just dropped for the general non-paying public. So people can just now use that and see what they can do with it. So we were using this. And, you know, the reason that I specified that genre was because I wanted to give it something really challenging, something that I didn't think it could do, frankly. Because, you know, the previous things that have done this were pretty good at doing like instrumental futuristic dance tracks, very artificial, very synthetic. But this was the most organic thing I could think of. This was, I think, the third iteration. We sort of tweaked the prompt. You know, and I think some people thought I was hyping my reaction. No hype at all. I was really amazed, disturbed, unsettled, freaked out. I still get goosebumps listening to it because it's an alien thing. It shouldn't exist.
It is bizarre. And I mean, even the lyrics, I'm just a soul trapped in circuitry. Like, it's very, I mean,
yes,
sophisticated in that way. I mean, you mentioned that Suno just released version 3 of their technology to the public, and that's the model that created this song. Tell us, like, how does this actually work?
So, you know, there's an answer to that in which you could say that even the people who made it don't really know. On some level, because they use the term black box for large language models like ChatGPT, because once you feed the training data into it, the people working on it don't really know what it does with it to get these new products. But I mean, a more direct answer is they extensively trained an audio generation model. Now, what they won't reveal, and some people are understandably a bit up in arms about this, they won't reveal what they trained it with, what songs, what audio they gave it. And I don't think it's a wild supposition to imagine that some copyrighted material was included, because one of the lead investors in Suno told me that, hey, we might get sued. But it's clearly been extensively trained on a lot of stuff. And, you know, I've been covering AI music for over a year now, which isn't that long, but it's an eternity in AI terms. And some of the leading experts in the field told me that one thing that won't exist for a long time is an interface where you just type a description of a song and then it comes up with vocals and melody and a finished song. It's just that, you know, that's going to take way longer because of the complexity of audio and music.
Right.
And I'll be damned. And so that was the other reason why I was so blown away by this is it's just way ahead of schedule.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned this VC saying, yeah, we'll probably get sued. Are they sort of preparing for that?
I don't know whether they're literally preparing for the suit, but seem to expect that it might happen. Because, you know, ChatGPT is obviously facing multiple lawsuits from companies, copyright owners that say they were trained on their data. And, you know, I think people forget that there actually is not, to my knowledge, a legal precedent that you're not allowed to do that. That's still being established. People are acting like the courts have already decided that you're not allowed to do that. Actually, that's still in progress. So there was one mention of, oh, you know, from the investor that maybe eventually there'll be some kind of licensing system. So we'll see.
They kind of frame this not as, oh, a potential sort of replacement for a musical artist, but they say they want to democratize music making and give people tools to just like generate their own music at home.
What they say is, you know, first of all, if you make a song with Suno and put it on Spotify, the way it works is Suno wouldn't make a dime from that. So that's not their business model. They can't stop you from doing that, and they don't really care whether you do that, but that's not what they're about. What they say they're about is really making songs for like the group chat, basically, like making a song to share with your friends. That's right now the use case that they see.
Do you buy it?
To a certain extent, I do, just in the sense that I know what their business model is, which is, you know, it's they think that it's so fun to play with that people will pay the $10 a month or whatever it is to play with it. And I have to say, although I'm still working out my own feelings about the ethics of this, it is really fun to play with. And I play music for real myself, but it's still very fun to play with.
As do all the creators of this. You talk about how their office has guitars and other musical instruments lying around. I want to play another piece of Suno-generated music. Our producer, Zeke Reed, made it, and he used the simple prompt, soulful, danceable R&B. We start to move and see. Bodies glide, lost in the music, two souls entwined. So let's dance, oh baby, let's dance all night long to the beat of our heart. This feeling is so strong, we're connected like a melody and rhyme. In this moonlit groove, together we shine. Ooh. I mean, it kind of sounds like a top 40 song, or at least an attempt at one. What's your reaction to that?
No, it's pretty good. I mean, you know, there's a few cases in which I can imagine professional uses for it already. And in my story, I talked to a major manager of producers and songwriters, and he said that he can see a world, and this is unfortunate, where for the lower end of songs and commercials and in the background of TV shows, which are, we call that sync licenses, and it can be very lucrative for musicians, and a lot of times it's songs that no one's ever heard of, he could see this tool or a more advanced iteration of it replacing that market. And that's a little scary for musicians. On another use level for professionals, I could imagine someone taking something like that and using one of the other AI tools that allows you to strip tracks from each other and just taking one part of it and building something else off of it. I think there's, frankly, a billion use cases like that that I haven't even gotten my head around. If you have a set of lyrics, you can generate infinite songs from that set of lyrics. And I can also imagine, if a songwriter was open to it, just using that as kind of like an idea starter.
Right.
That is, I can't imagine that, because I do write my songs myself, and it was extraordinary to plug my actual lyrics into it and hear it sung by like what sounds like a professional female R&B singer or whatever. It's wild. It's really wild.
crazy. Well, and that sort of tracks with what I think we've seen some folks use things like ChatGPT for, you know, like this idea of like, oh, just get something on paper and then I'll write through it. So I do think there's opportunity here, like you said, to almost collaborate with this AI for musicians. But yeah, you also mentioned, you know, commercial artists, folks who write those little ditties in the back of advertisements and, you know, intro and outro music. I mean, what are the other concerns? I know you talked to Living Color guitarist Vernon Reed about sort of like bigger ethical, racial, you know, systemic concerns here.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. My sort of sense of the possibilities of this thing and the possibility that it might not be all bad is very much accompanied by my concerns over putting humans out of business. And I spoke to Vernon specifically because when I did my last AI story, he was very vocal about both the fact that he thought that AI was more capable than what most people thought, but also that it could be more dangerous to human musicians than most people thought. He said that he had a combination of wonder, shock, and horror. And he pointed out specifically, like, the fact that it's a blues created by a machine is really disturbing. It's in a tradition of Black art being taken and appropriated and profited upon without the involvement of the actual artists who made it. You know, what he said is that the use of an African-American idiom deeply tied to historical human trauma and enslavement, which is what the blues is, merely to demonstrate how close to human the AI can become is disturbing. And he's right. And he also said, you know, and this is an extraordinary quote he sent me. He said, the long-running dystopian ideal of separating difficult, messy, undesirable, and despised humanity from its creative output is at hand.
Yeah. Oof. It's, I mean, the promise and the perils are, like, so vivid already. I wonder, like, it can't do live music, but can it, though?
One of the panels I've hosted recently about AI music had like a real tech guy who said that there's going to be an AI artist as popular as Taylor Swift within 10 years. And I basically was like, you are nuts. Like, that you don't understand people, because people are so attached to the artist that it's almost like the audio product is just a part of what an artist does. And I think if you can't connect it to a human, it's not going to have the same thing.
This version 3 is out there. We've seen, obviously, things like ChatGPT take off. What are you kind of going to be watching for in the coming months?
I'm very curious to see how viral it goes. I'm curious whether they're going to get sued. You know, I think it says something about people's basic humanity that when ChatGPT first launched, most of the reaction, at least that I saw initially, was sort of awe and wonder, you know, of what this thing could do. It's really interesting to see how fast that turned from that awe and wonder to, from a lot of people you hear, I'm wildly against this. They're talking about boycotting that horror movie because it used 3 quick AI images in the course of a 2-hour movie. You know, people were mad that we even wrote about Suno. They were mad that we used it. There's a real kind of anti-AI feeling that I completely understand. I mean, you know, when Napster came out and people were downloading music for free, the overwhelming public mood was sort of like, who cares about the record industry? Who cares about the artists? They're ripping us off. I think it's because Napster didn't seem like it might come for your job too. and now because AI feels threatening to everyone, I think there's an interesting new level of solidarity that I've never seen before where people actually care about the creators. And if that leads people to care more about creators, that's great.
Well, hopefully you and I don't get replaced by AI ourselves.
Exactly.
Right. All right. Brian Hyatt is a senior writer at Rolling Stone. He also hosts the Rolling Stone Music Now podcast. Check it out. Thanks for speaking with us, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, a conversation with musician Alinda Segarra of Hooray for the Riff Raff. They're playing Friday at the Belasco Theater. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand. That is Hawk Moon. It's a new song by the singer-songwriter Alinda Segarra, a.k.a. Hooray for the Riff Raff. As a teenager, Segarra dropped out of high school and left their home in the Bronx on a freight train. They spent years as a runaway traveler, riding the rails and seeing some of the brightest and darkest corners of the country. Eventually, Segarra settled in New Orleans and focused on music. And they've since put out a slate of critically acclaimed albums under the Hooray for the Riff Raff name. The newest one is called The Past is Still Alive. It's an autobiographical reflection on a life spent traveling. And Hooray for the Riff Raff is also playing at the Belasco Theater on Friday, April 5th. Alinda Segarra joins me now. Welcome to Press Play, Alinda.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here. As I said, this is an autobiographical album, and the music really makes you feel like you're on the open road traveling around, or you should be at least. I'm curious, like, how much of it is about yourself or the people you've met along the way in your travels?
It's definitely a look back on places and moments and people that I've experienced throughout, I mean, having this band and before having this band, you know, just trying to figure out what I take with me and what I leave behind and just how to honor it all.
Yeah. I wonder if you could take us back a little bit to when you were just 17 years old. You grew up in the Bronx. Was there something that drew you to see trains as an escape or opportunity growing up in New York?
Well, it was actually through music, because I started to get really, I was in the punk scene. That's what I gravitated towards, and going to DIY shows. And I was really drawn to political music. Mm. And then through that, I found folk music, American folk music, and started hearing songs by people like Woody Guthrie. And also, I was really obsessed with poetry, reading the beat poets. So I had this fascination with going to like the smallest town in America, you know, coming from the Bronx and being a New York City kid. I was really into the idea of going into the wide open spaces of America and seeing what this country was like.
That's interesting. So it was less of an escape from something and maybe a search for something. The grass is greener a little bit.
Yeah. And I think I also had this understanding that I wasn't built to live the type of hustling New York City life that I was born into. I was doing really terrible in school. I knew I had something to offer, but I didn't know what it was. And, you know, through the punk scene, I met a lot of kids that were traveling and living on the road. And it seemed like that was my destiny. There was something that just called to me about it. And I was also really searching for community because I felt very much like I didn't belong. Mm. So that's where I found like-minded people and kind of created like my own family.
Well, I want to play a little bit more of music. This song is called Alibi.
Falling out my heart like meat. I see your track marks broken through your hoodie sleeve. Tic-tac-toe game to the destiny. I grieve. Marching towards the East River Park. You told me your big secret on the FDR. I couldn't hear you over the choppers and the buzzing cars. So far. You know the time can take.
That is Alibi. It's a new song by my guest, Alinda Segarra. Alinda, I mean, I didn't even want to stop the music. It's such a beautiful song. And it sounds like this one takes place in New York, if I'm not wrong. Can you just talk a little bit about what you're writing about here?
Well, growing up in New York and also just, I would say, in a community of radical-minded people, of artists, of outsiders, you encounter addiction a lot. And this was a song that I wrote for some of the people in my life who I've seen really struggle with addiction, some people that I've lost, and just trying to write like a song that could be kind of a soothing balm, but also that still recognizes the complexities of being the person on the outside of the struggle who wants to help and doesn't know how.
Mm. Well, Alinda, addiction is a bit of a theme on this album. I want to play another song. This is Snake Plant, The Past is Still Alive.
tattoo with a needle and thread. Most of our old friends are dead. So tested drugs, remember Narcan. There's a war on the people, what don't you understand? There's fentanyl in everything. Don't become an angel with a broken wing. Oh, we need you back down here on earth. And nothing is as painful as birth. Well, time flies when you're getting old, but I was born with a baby boy's soul. Maybe someday I'll see you again in a field of war, a kingdom of sand. And maybe we could smile again. Oh, maybe we could dance again. I'd kiss your lips, I'd hold your hands. Oh, maybe we could dance again. Well, I was young when I left home. I never stopped running, used to think I was alone.
That was Snake Plant, The Past Is Still Alive, from Hooray for the Riff Raff's new album. Alinda, I don't feel like we hear a lot of songs calling out Narcan by name, encouraging folks to test their drugs. Tell me a little bit about this song and this lyrics.
Well, the song itself is definitely a memoir. This was the first song I wrote for this album, and it was me writing song as memoir because I was a little bit too afraid to try to take on the work of starting a memoir. While I was writing, I got to this chapter, which is like the verse, you know, the second verse and, or the third verse of it, I should say. And I was called to write these lyrics because I suddenly realized that I hadn't heard anything talking about this issue. A lot of, you know, different substances and people are experimenting or people are battling with addiction. And we're losing people in huge numbers. And we have this life-saving medicine that I think should be free and available everywhere, which is Narcan. It reverses overdose. So in the spirit of the folk music that I first fell in love with, I wanted to write these lyrics because this is what's actually happening. This is the reality. And I think that's like the beauty of song, is you can spread information, you can make people feel not alone, and you can also create a time capsule for people in the future to know what we were dealing with now. So to partner with it on tour, we've had Narcan available for free at all of our shows. Oh, wow. Which feels really good to, you know, put the lyrics into action.
Yeah, and I wonder if just like making it part of the cultural zeitgeist like this takes away some of the stigma too, right? It's like, We need to be talking about this.
Yeah, I really believe that in the ideas of harm reduction. I learned a lot from people in New Orleans, community members and community leaders that were talking about this issue, especially after lockdown. Mm-hmm. So many people that are struggling with addiction, lockdown was such a hard time for them. So I really believe in just being grown-ups and being like, yeah, this is what's happening. We could try to pretend that people don't have issues with drug use, but the reality is some really incredible people do, and I want to see them alive.
Absolutely. You left New York, as we talked about before, and you saw a lot of the country, but you ended up settling in New Orleans. How did you sort of discover it for yourself?
Well, I ended up there while I was still traveling, and it was in New Orleans that I started playing music. At the time, I was just kind of like doing weird odd jobs or literally asking for money on the street. And when I got to New Orleans, I found out that you could play music on the street, which was something I've always wanted to do. I was always obsessed with music. And I ended up forming a street band down there. And through that, I just was welcomed and supported by so many artists in that city. And I fell in love with the history of New Orleans and the music. I just think it's one of the most special places on earth.
I can totally appreciate that, especially as a musician, how you would just like feel at home there, where music is so much part of the sort of like, I don't know, like the personality of the city itself.
For sure. And also New Orleans taught me a lot about music being a part of your daily life and a part of your rituals and a part of community. I think it was really important for me to start this band in New Orleans because there in that city, music is used for when you're grieving. It's used when you're celebrating. It's such a public act. It's not just about making a career. It's about a community, you know, act. So I think all of that has been infused in what I think about when I make this band and when I write songs and make albums.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Alinda Segarra, who records as Hooray for the Riff Raff, and they're also performing at the Belasco Theater on Friday, April 5th. Let's play another song here. This is called Ogallala. I understand it's named after a town in Nebraska. Let's hear it.
Now what do you turn into when all reality's blending? An image of a photocopy of.
Powerful and pressing. Talk a little bit about what you're saying here. You're talking about that you used to dream of living in another era, but now you feel strongly about living right now.
Yeah, when I first started to write songs, I felt like I really didn't belong in what was happening in like popular music, you know, at the time. I found myself gravitating, of course, towards Bob Dylan and Neil Young and the Beatles and all of these really incredible moments in American music around like the 60s and 70s. And I felt like, oh, I just missed my time, you know? And the more we are faced with really big challenges as a country and big challenges as a planet, the more I feel really grounded in I'm happy that I'm here. And whether I'm happy or not, I am here. Right. So I want to use this time intentionally. And instead of thinking about and romanticizing these past periods that were also incredibly difficult for their own reasons, I want to be present in the moment. And I want to also appreciate all the incredible artists that are coming out right now.
That's interesting because it's a more hopeful sort of take than I maybe had expected you to talk about. I mean, it does feel right now sometimes like the world is burning around all of us.
Well, yeah, and it is. That I mean, especially living in New Orleans, I have witnessed so much of climate catastrophe and the effects that it has on people and the effects it has, you know, depending on your class and your race. And it's been really eye-opening to be there and see what's happening. But at the same time, I guess I don't even know if it's hope. It's more like I feel like this is my duty and I feel a strong commitment to younger generations than me to try and just be as brave as I can. And I don't think being brave means that you don't have fear. You know, I'm really afraid of what's happening to our planet. I also, at the same time, I'm just kind of like rededicating myself to this is my work. I'm going to do it as bravely as I can and not shy away from the realities because there are kids that are depending on us.
Well, Alinda, I would love to go out on your song Dynamo. Can you set that up for us?
Yeah, this one is a really fun one. It's about just like a wandering woman who's like, you can't help but love her, but she's chaos and that's a part of why you love her.
I love that. Alinda, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Alinda Segarra. They make music under the name Hooray for the Riff Raff. Check out their new album, The Past is Still Alive. And check out their show on Friday, April 5th at the Belasco Theater. My baby, oh. That does it for today on Press Play. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos. Thanks for listening today. We'll see you tomorrow.